Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Jeff's rugby team will depart in 5 minutes from platform 15. Your ride comes with 6 toilets and a refreshments carriage that you'll empty within 5 minutes. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
Hey, Immigrantly family, Sadia here. I have something special for your feed today. Now, you know how we're always talking about the invisible rules that immigrant communities navigate? The ones nobody explains to you until it's too late. This episode from our friends at More Muslim is exactly that. Reporter Tanida Rahmani went deep on a legal gray zone that affects a lot of Muslim women in the West. What happens when your nikah is recognized by your faith, but invisible to the law you actually live under? And the answers she found are not what you would expect. This one is reported with so much care and honesty. I think you're going to love it. Come back next week for a new Immigrantly episode. Until then, I hope you enjoyed this one.
Some people get married in the countryside, some at a destination wedding. I got married in a more industrial part of town, in Red Hook, Brooklyn. I remember it was early in the morning. I was in the white dress, and I walked past this row of big trucks and commercial warehouses. And someone came up to me and asked, "Ma'am, are you in the right place?" But I knew where I was headed.
Tanida Rahmani is a reporter and producer, and her story starts on the day of her wedding in October 2022.
Super excited that we are all here virtually in person to celebrate the love of these two beautiful, wonderful people.
And it wasn't your conventional wedding.
Start showing you the
it started at 8 a.m.
What everything's going to look like.
Have the guests join over Zoom.
My brother away.
There was dancing. And overall, it was a beautiful ceremony.
Where did you guys meet?
So we were both at this Muslim event at NYU. I mean, I was mostly there for the food, but I stayed late to help clean up the venue. And there was this guy with long wavy hair who walked out at the same time. And he said, "Salam." We had a short conversation and ended up walking to the same subway stop. Months later, we were getting married.
Classic MSA romance.
You know, actually, our wedding was officiated by the imam from NYU.
When we look at the life of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we see that he had this deep love for his wife.
He gave this beautiful speech.
She would ask him, "What is the state of the love that you have for me?" And he would say, "It's like a bound up knot. The more you pull on it, the tougher, the stronger it gets."
Then he turned to us for the actual nikah.
"Like many things, it's quite simple. There's not so much complexity to it."
He asked us for the job in Kabul,
where our brother Maruf is going to put forward the offer for marriage.
And then it was time to seal the deal.
We're going to really quickly just sign some of the marriage licenses and documents, after which...
But then, when it was time to sign it, I couldn't do it.
What do you mean you couldn't do it? You changed your mind?
We didn't have the right pen.
Wait, what does a pen have to do with it?
Okay, so apparently you can only sign the marriage license with a pen that has a black ink. And we only had a pen with a blue ink. We had no idea there was a rule like that. So we weren't able to sign it because we didn't have the right kind of pen.
And nobody in the entire hall had a black pen?
You know, honestly, we didn't really think it would be a big deal at the time. You know, like we had all these people and we didn't want to keep them waiting. So we just went ahead with the rest of the ceremony. But then after I got home, I couldn't help but think. From an Islamic perspective, we were definitely married. We did the nikah and everything. But were we like married, married? Like in the eyes of the state, married? And it got me thinking about this limbo state. Married under the eyes of God, but unseen by the eyes of the law. I started looking into it. And I found out I wasn't alone. A ton of Muslim women find themselves stuck in the same limbo. So I ended up spending months reporting on this legal gray zone. And as I heard more of their stories, I realized there's a lot more at stake than just logistics.
A lot of these couples young, it's all romantic and fun, because as far as they were concerned, the nikah was all that they needed.
Because of course, no one wants to think about the bad stuff when you're first getting married. But the way a marriage begins, sometimes has a lot to do with how it might end.
Why should anyone be allowed to marry somebody and then just flick them like they're a flea?
They've got beards, they've got women wearing hijab, and they're saying that she's no wife of mine.
And as I stood in my own limbo of whether or not to legally register my marriage, it turned everything I thought I understood about this topic upside down.
This week on the show, reporter Tanita Rahmani takes us on an investigative journey into this unique legal gray zone, a space lots of Muslims find themselves in, and asks, what happens when your marriage is recognized by faith, but invisible to the law you live under? I'm Sohar Siddiqui. This is More Muslim.
Before we start, just want to make sure, how do you want to be called throughout this interview?
Gosh, Suraya?
Yeah.
That's a nice name.
So I want to start with Suraya's story. She didn't want to share her real name, but she's from the UK. And her family is originally from India.
Not necessarily a conservative family, but quite sort of balanced.
Suraya was young when she got married, only 21.
I think the better way to describe it is an introductory marriage. We were introduced by the family. The meeting was only for about half an hour. And then you must decide whether you want to spend the rest of your life with this person. Which is sort of looking back, you think, goodness, was that me? Did I do that?
It was a long time ago, back in 2001.
And on paper, he was very good. The potential to have a decent life was there.
She says yes. And 3 weeks later, she has her nikah, has a party to celebrate.
I organized the whole thing and had the party, which was quite small for Asians. I mean, it was about 150, 170 people.
And that was that, the start of a new life.
I was quite excited because at that time I thought, you know, it's sort of moving forward with my life at the tender age of 21, goodness me.
But soon after she moved in, things started to get messy.
We went through a period where we were not getting on.
Suraya told me she was on her way back from work one day. And when she got to the door, she realized
the locks were changed when I came home from work.
Her husband refused to let her in.
And then he did the three-sitting divorce. I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. Done. And that was it. We were divorced.
Back when Suraya had that small ceremony for her nikah,
it's very much, you're going to be married and that's it. That's your life. That's for life.
It never occurred to her that things might end.
Divorce is never, ever mentioned. It's never part of anyone's vocabulary.
And so she didn't spend much time thinking about registering her marriage, and her husband never really brought it up either. So when they got to the court, she found out why.
He was actually on the stand And he was asked a question, and then that's where he actually denied us being married in the first place. I thought, come on, I mean, that's a bit silly. I'm going to excuse my language, what a twat. But I stood my ground, I stood my case, and that's where I then produced my evidence that actually we were. Here are the wedding invitation, here is the wedding tape, here is the nikah certificate, etc.
She says even the judge seemed sympathetic. There was just so much proof that they were married. But the law couldn't help her.
Because essentially we weren't married in the court of law and in the eyes of the law. If you just have the nikah but not register your marriage, under the law of England and Wales, you are entitled to absolutely nothing. Why should anyone be allowed to think that they can marry somebody and then sort of just flick them like they're a flea?
After learning Saraya's story, I talked to a lawyer, a woman named Anna Han. And she told me, in the years after Saraya took her case to the court, her team started getting calls on this strange phenomenon.
That we're constantly getting calls on a particular subject, and they started calling it Nikah Horror Story.
Marriage after marriage, turning into a nightmare.
And I said, well, this is happening too often, not just a few times a week, but several times a day.
Anna told me about this one woman. She was happily married for 30 years until her husband unexpectedly passed away. And all of a sudden, she was getting thrown out of her house, all because the in-laws wanted the house back.
They say it's our house. We've inherited it under the law. You're nothing.
And as these cases kept flooding Anna's office, she started to wonder, what was happening in her Muslim community?
They've got beards. They've got women wearing hijab. And they're saying that she's no wife of mine. Why would somebody do that? It was absolutely appalling for me. As a lawyer, as a practicing Muslim woman, you feel a sense of deep distress that your faith gave all the rights 1400 years ago that we could want.
Anna told me that Islamic law has always given women rights in a divorce. Nikahs are supposed to be treated like contracts with protections for women when they're getting a divorce. They're like guardrails against hasty divorces. They grant alimony and child support, and the woman should always get the mahar that she was promised. Traditionally in Muslim societies, those contracts were always enforced by Sharia courts, courts operating under the power of an Islamic government. But the problem nowadays is, with so many Muslims living in non-Muslim countries, there's no one to enforce them. Anna was alarmed. She decided to do something about it.
Think a religious marriage gives you rights? Think again. Join the Register Our Marriage campaign today and help us change lives.
Back in 2012, Anna started a campaign which would eventually be named Register Our Marriage.
I would give a speech and I would choose to make this the topic. Did you know this is something that's happening? Everyone would be shocked, jaws hitting the ground.
With a small team of volunteers, she started going all around England and Wales, having meeting after meeting with local imams.
The imams say to me, oh, thank goodness you told us about this and we've learned.
This is something people need to know.
We need to tell people, at least give them an informed choice.
And slowly and steadily, the campaign started to grow. And word started to spread.
People started phoning in to say, we're also suffering from this.
You go in thinking, obviously, this marriage is never going to end.
Whereas if I'd known beforehand, I would have arranged a civil ceremony. You just don't know what's around the corner.
Husband dies, you've got nothing. Pension, nothing.
Left with nothing. Not even being able to move on. It's just a difficult situation.
Soon, the British government started to notice too.
They phoned me in 2017 to say, we've been hearing about these roadshows you've been running, and we're going to fund you to have full-time staff members who can launch this properly nationwide.
Which is when the campaign really blew up.
Let me bring in Anna Khan now, the founder and director of Register Our Marriage campaign. Good to have you on.
It became huge in 2017.
It's only when a relationship breaks down that many Muslims realise that in the eyes of UK law, they were never married in the first place.
I would go out to Islamic expos and fairs.
I feel very strongly that the law is a complete mess.
I would talk about it in media and programmes.
And that's why I set up the campaign Register Our Marriage.
So that was fantastic, and it really made an impact.
At one of these Islamic conferences, Anna met an imam who'd been waging his own campaign for marriage registration, but had been getting slightly different results.
So around about 2008 or 2009, I began to educate people about it, make noise about it.
Imam Musharraf Hussain is an Islamic teacher and mosque leader in Nottingham. And back then, he was so convinced about the importance of registration, he even used his mosque's community radio station to put out the word.
Brothers and sisters, do your nikah, but don't forget, register your marriage with the state.
He had gotten his mosque license to do civil marriages.
Look, we are not registered, so do please come and see us so we can book in this registrar as well. And both things, the nikah and the civil marriage, can take place together here in our mosque.
But
I think we got a very poor response. People were not interested. And so it's been quite a poor uptake.
His outreach didn't quite land.
I was quite anxious about that. And I really did have a real goes at those people, actually, some of my congregation who didn't do it that way.
In fact, he was so stubborn about it, it started costing him.
I remember one of the members of the congregation whose son was getting married, and because he was very close, I tried to persuade him actually quite a lot, telling him all the benefits and how it is. And of course, I don't think anything was going in his head at all. And then he wanted the nikah to be done.
Imam Musharraf took a stand. He refused to marry them if the son didn't register his marriage.
I said, no, I'm not going to do it if you don't have this. So that is how harsh I was about it initially, yes.
But the family was stubborn too. And they said, if you're not going to do it, we're just going to find someone else.
I was willing to lose friends over it. You know, when I do something, I'm very determined. And I do it for a reason. We'd spent so much time and effort getting that registration. It wasn't easy. And when nobody's taking it up, it does worry you.
Imam Musharraf didn't get it. Why was his community pushing back so much? Why wouldn't people want to register their marriages?
I don't think the state should be there telling people that they need to marry, because they wouldn't be telling cohabitants that they need to marry. You know, it is a liberal democracy at the end of the day.
Coming up after the break, the perils of registration. Anna Han, the lawyer from London, was busy with her Register of Marriage campaign in 2012. The campaign she started to hopefully end unregistered religious marriages. Meanwhile, Rajnara Akhtar was in grad school studying family law.
I began looking at this whole non-legally binding marriage space.
Just like Anna and Imam Musharraf, Rajnara started hearing the same nikah horror stories. And Rajnara, too, thought something needed to change.
For me, it did not sit well. There were all of these women who were being left effectively financially high and dry.
But before she could go into solutions mode, Rajnara decided to interview Muslim women from all over the UK. And to her, it was really interesting to uncover reasons why.
Reasons why people would choose to be in a non-legally binding marriage.
What she learned was that the majority just didn't get around to it.
So the idea that the marriage is really important, but by that they mean the nikah, a lot of these couples young, you know what it's like. They don't think about things like that because it's all romantic and fun. Generally speaking, the older people get, the more likely they are to ensure that there are some legal parameters to their relationship. But that tends to just come with age, wisdom, and usually children in a house.
But then there was another group of people that Rachnara came across.
A minority had a view that ideologically they wouldn't marry, because as far as they were concerned, the nikah was all that they needed. They're married in the sight of God, and why would they require anything else?
And these people didn't sound like they were being careless. For example, I spoke to one woman named Sajila. Back in 1994, Sajila was going to get married. But a year before that, she had just lost her dad.
I've come back to this, the kind of grief ground zero, if you like.
And in the haze of her grief,
suddenly I'm getting married. And like, I don't know, are we right for each other?
She wasn't as sure of her decisions anymore.
I don't know if he's the one, and or if there is the one. So I don't know, a lot of things.
But she decided to go through with the nikah. And in the days and weeks after, she wondered, should she register it or not?
I knew in my head I wasn't going to do it. I felt more trapped by the registry than the Islamic nikah.
Because the way Sajila saw it,
something about that seemed really final and ominous.
It felt like losing something. Her freedom.
Not like the physical space of freedom, like going out or doing things. It was the freedom in my head to be me, authentically, 100% me, that I didn't belong to him or anyone else. You know, I don't know if that makes sense. And I know this is where I think I'm not the right kind of Muslim. I felt I was losing me if we did that. And it was like, I'm losing part of me.
So Julia and her ex-husband divorced many years ago. She was 3 months pregnant with her first son. They never did end up registering the nikah. And so after the divorce, she was left with nothing. No assets, no legally mandated support for her unborn child.
My friends always used to argue afterwards. They said, you're an idiot. You should have basically married him because you left with nothing. And I said, I don't want assets. I don't give a shit about that.
She says all she had wanted all along was the ability to choose for herself.
That's more valuable.
Hearing stories like Sajila's made Rachnara think again.
Perhaps the kind of steps I'd expect the state to take go against my usual values on this. I think that if you choose with full knowledge to be in a non-legally binding marriage, that's up to you.
If you deliberately choose to have an unregistered marriage, what right do people like Anna or Imam Musharraf have to say anything? What right does the government have?
I think these calls for compelled registration of marriages, they are calling for the regulation of certain relationships while others are allowed to continue without any regulation. I think that's wrong. I don't think they should be telling people that they need to marry, because they wouldn't be telling cohabitants that they need to marry. You know, it is a liberal democracy at the end of the day.
At this point in my reporting, I realized Rachnara wasn't the only one having a change of heart. Others were too, including those I never expected to. More on that after the break.
Tanita, believe me, we told them everything.
To go back to Imam Musharraf, the one leading his own campaign for registration, he told me he continued to push.
It sort of boosts your energy and you feel, wow, I know I'm right. I believed I was right. I think this is a good idea and we should keep at it and promote it.
But a few years ago, he remembers attending a conference, a gathering of imams from around Britain.
Special meeting for the summer conference.
They were sharing the things they've been working on. So Imam Musharraf talks about his efforts trying to get people to register their Islamic marriages.
I'd shown them my disappointment at it as well. I'm not having much success. And I think I was just sharing my experience to see how they would react and what they would have to say.
And how did they react?
Well, one of them, the very senior one, really said, look, I think the nikah is sufficient. Why should a Muslim also get a civil marriage when everything is, it's self-contained, it's powerful, it's good enough? Why put another layer of legal restrictions and burden on something which is already a very heavy contract? So it gave me some very food for thought.
It got him thinking. So he went back to the source. He started going through the Quran to seek more clarity on this topic.
There's a very beautiful surah, you know, called Talaq. I do recommend, Tanita, you read that. And it is just amazing. You know, six times God speaks in that two pages.
He saw how Allah addresses those who are embarking on the journey of divorce.
Believers, that's both man and woman. What's your problem? Why are you worried? I'm your Lord. You're going to have a great life now. Don't lose hope. Be optimistic. Look forward to a great life. And that kind of, oh my goodness, it is mind-blowing.
And in life, some things just don't work out.
We know that divorce is a most wicked sort of thing to happen. However, we know that humans will tend to have these problems in life. It's inevitable. We really do need to make sure that we have easier and fairer ways of exiting.
Rajnara, the legal scholar, also told me something similar.
There is an interesting dimension to this, and it's almost the elephant in the room.
She says, in the British legal system,
that it is really hard to exit a legally binding marriage. So what the studies support is those who have had a legally binding marriage and divorce are very reluctant to enter into another legally binding marriage. They find it much easier to navigate a non-legally binding one.
And I was surprised to hear that some of the women I had spoken to earlier were thinking along similar lines. For example, Saraya, the same woman whose husband locked her out and suddenly divorced her, when she looked back on it many years later...
In hindsight, looking at myself, yes, I think it should be recognised, but from a very, very selfish perspective, I'm happy that mine actually eventually wasn't.
She was ultimately glad that she hadn't registered her marriage.
I know that's not the right thing to say, but in hindsight, I'm glad mine personally wasn't, because it's just made things for me a lot sort of clean cut.
And at some point, Imam Musharraf too came out with a different perspective.
This really, it took a long time, and there was a long incubation period before I came to this idea that, look, you know, I would really prefer people to stick to their Sharia law only. And if they want to get civil marriage, fine. So I'm now very relaxed, whereas in the past I was very anxious, and I really did have a real goes at those people.
At this point, I found myself thinking about something Rajnara said to me.
I think what is interesting here is the example from Australia. So Australia has this recognition of the de facto relationship. And what that means is if you're cohabiting and you haven't legally married, if you meet certain criteria, then the state will recognise that that's a family and there are some rights that are attached to it.
For example, when the couple separates, one of them can receive financial support when a child is in the picture. Or a right to share property when one of them passes away.
Before the principle takes effect. So in my mind, that is the exact right approach.
Like, maybe it doesn't have to be as simple as a choice, where you have freedom on one side and legal protection on the other.
because you're allowing people to navigate the space as they want. Perhaps they'll have a ceremony that's meaningful to them in some way. Perhaps they won't. The state doesn't have to involve itself in that.
Maybe there's a third path where even women who never register their marriages could still get protections.
So I think it's important for us to understand that this, that the discussions we're having are the minority, but it's the minority that need protecting.
Rajnara points out that it really shouldn't matter whether you register your marriage or not. Whether you thought about the end at the beginning, a shared life is a shared life. And that should mean something in the eyes of the law. My reporting began with a personal question. As a Muslim in the West with an unregistered marriage, I wanted to understand why this issue is more than just basic bureaucracy. Why does it matter? And why are different people making these very different choices? Along the way, it made me uncomfortable to think about how making this decision about my new marriage was ultimately also a decision about how it might end. Like when you're just starting out, it already comes with its own level of stress, you know? On top of that, I was suddenly thinking about my own marriage through a lens of what-ifs. But after hearing all these perspectives, I knew I had to make a choice.
Test, test. After registering my marriage in the US, I flew to the Maldives where my husband is from.
We are leaving the house from Guradu to Male. It is around 7:30 a.m. Okay.
Today, the water is calm, the sun is gentle.
Hey, love, there's just the luggage, yeah?
We walk towards the harbor, waiting for a speedboat to take us to Male.
Are you making a video game?
Always making a video, right?
Yeah.
Hey, are you going to school today?
No, I can't because...
That's Sally, one of our nephews. He's joining us too. After 45 minutes in the Indian Ocean...
So close to what?
We arrive in Male, at the family court. We've been going back and forth with the family court in the last few weeks, and we've been preparing documents for the last few months. Today is finally the day. The day that a judge will verify us and our marriage. Hopefully get it registered. So we enter this long, echoey room. And there's this huge wooden table on one end. I almost didn't see the judge who was wearing red sitting right behind it. And there was no hello, no nonsense. He goes straight to the questions. Your wife's name is Tanita. And this is her dad's name. And here's where she was born. And she was born Muslim? He's verifying me. He's verifying my husband. And basically, all of our family history. It feels like I'm in a mini hearing of some sort. Moments later, he gives this ear-to-ear smile and says, okay, finish.
Thank you so much.
We step out of the room, we feel victorious. We sign a few papers, then one of the officers stops us. She tells us we need to pay a fine. A pretty hefty one too. The reason? Because we registered the marriage late. Like so late. I asked my husband if, hey, maybe we should look up the regulation first. You know, like fact checking.
Is that something you want to double check?
want. I just want to get it done. I don't want to be dealing with this. Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy. Yeah, like, it's so...
Like, they don't make it easy. No. It's like the money.
And honestly, that sums up how I feel too. I'm just so glad that it's all done.
Muslim is hosted by Sohaira Siddiqui and created by Salman Ahad Khan. This episode was reported by me, Tanita Rahmani, with additional production from Najib Amini and Salman Ahad Khan. Editing, sound design, and original music by Salman Ahad Khan. Additional editing by Sarah Khadi. Fact-checked by Heba El-Urbani. Additional music, sound design, and engineering by Alexander Overington. Production support by Rabia Bushra, Sonia Ruhi, and Sarah Diab. This season of More Muslim is powered by Al Mujadila, a centered mosque for women in Qatar. If you like our show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. More about our show at moremuslim.org. New episodes out every 2 weeks. Thank you for listening.